From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made, and we're just pleased and honored to welcome Bishop William Wiegand, Bishop Emeritus William Wiegand. Bishop, good day to you.
Bob, thank you. Same to you and all of the listeners.
Of which there are many, thanks to you. And you're the one who had the brainchild here to have the Bishop's Hour. We're now, you probably find this hard to believe, we're now in our 22nd year.
Yeah, that's making us both a bit older than
me. Don't say it. Yeah, indeed it is. You are celebrating, or have celebrated, I guess you can celebrate all year, your 40th anniversary of your episcopal ordination, 57 years as a Catholic priest.
Yes, that is true. And they've been, in terms of priesthood, 57 years, but 40 as a bishop, wonderful years, very active, lots of opportunities, not a few challenges and difficulties, but lots of blessings.
Lots of blessings, yes. And I remember your 50th anniversary as a priest, and we had a gathering in a downtown hotel, and I've never seen so many bishops. There were a cardinal or two there. All to honor you, and I felt a little out of my element. I felt I was surrounded by so many holy men. I didn't know who to go to confession with.
Well, and that was a bit of a surprise to me too. Bishop Soto, my successor and the current bishop of Sacramento, planned that celebration and did more than I would have recommended, but it was nice, very nice.
It was a very, very nice evening, and I remember Dan Haverty was there too, a man you are very well connected to.
Yes, indeed. 15 years ago now, 15 plus, he donated a major part of his liver to me. In a living donor liver transplant, and he's done well. I've done well also. It's now 15 years. I kind of look on it as overtime in a way.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I was very close to going to God at that time, following many years dealing with a liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
And but it gave me a totally new lease on life. And so Dan and his family have become close friends of mine, just like family, actually.
Yeah, it's such a remarkable story. And I think prior to that, I didn't realize that you could have a living donor for a liver transplant. And I think a lot of other people probably didn't realize that either.
Well, 15 years ago, it was fairly new,
mm-hmm.
And I had my transplant, Dan and I, at the University of California, San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
Medical Center, and at that time, my recollection is that they had done 50 of these liver donor,
wow,
living donor liver transplants,
mm-hmm.
And no other... other major centers around the country also had done only about 50, so it was quite new.
Wow. I remember you telling me later that you woke up in your room afterward and saw your brother, and you said, well, I know I'm not in heaven.
That's actually true. But he now is in heaven.
That's what I understand.
That brother died a couple of years ago.
Mm.
And he's probably joking about that.
I bet he's laughing right now. Yes. That's, yeah. So Was the rehabilitation from that, was it long? Was it arduous? You hear about transplants and rejection and that sort of thing.
Well, no. And I was more blessed, luckier, I guess, in a way than some. Rehabilitation period basically was a couple of months,
mm-hmm.
but after only a couple of weeks, I was home, but I was already reading my mail and mm-hmm. Studying the issues that I had to make decisions on, and I was already working. And part-time, of course, and then soon I was going to the office again part-time, and
mm-hmm.
Within 2 months I was back to full speed. And in the meantime, the auxiliary bishop picked up the slack, Bishop Rich Garcia,
right,
and staff. So the transition, it was scary in terms of the unknowns, both on our part, but everyone in the diocese. But it just went very well. It was quite a blessing and also a witness. Dan Haverty's, Dan was the fire chief of the city of Folsom.
Right.
And was 50 years old at the time, but was at a good age, in good health. That he would do that, and with the full support of his wife, his
right.
mother was still living, she was in support, and their three children. So it was a family decision. It was a question of a family of deep Catholic faith.
Yeah.
They felt they were called to do that and were ready to deal with whatever came from it. They had a strong confidence that it would go well. But Dan's wife, at a dinner at their house before a couple of weeks before the surgery, told me very explicitly that if in fact it went well for me and not for her husband, Dan, the donor, that I should not worry about that. It would be all part of God's providence, and they would miss him, but they would understand that it was all part of God's plan.
Wow, what faith!
That's a great
story. Well, you know, and Dan, of course, looks like a linebacker for Notre Dame.
He's
a solid guy.
And Dan, of course, you know, but maybe listeners don't, since has become a study for several years and has become a permanent deacon
yes.
of the diocese.
Yes.
very active, very helpful to Bishop Soto and his own parish in the parish of Holy Trinity
mm-hmm.
in El Dorado Hills.
Right.
East of Sacramento.
Yeah, just off of Highway 50 there. I think it was at the Bass Road exit. I've been there a few times. What a view they have.
Yes, indeed. Uh-huh.
They can actually see Mount Diablo, so they can keep an eye on the devil.
But anyway, just yesterday, in spite of the lockdown in California, I celebrated the 10 a.m. Mass at the Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament,
mm-hmm.
and it was a special Mass because it was the Feast of Christ the King.
Right.
But it was also special because it was exactly the date, the Feast of Christ the King, and the exact date, November 22nd, 15 years ago. Just a few months after my liver transplant, we had the finishing of the restoration of
oh,
our
right.
historic cathedral
right.
and its rededication. And that's why I was offering that Mass. It was live streamed. There was a small kind of group in the church and others in the plaza adhering to the governor's rules about that, but many people by live stream. So it was a great walk down memory lane, in a sense. And 15 years ago, so a number of things coincided. It was my liver transplant, the rededication of our now a beautiful cathedral, the Blessed Sacrament. But at the same time, I was celebrating my 25th anniversary as a bishop.
Wow.
And the very day after the rededication, we had another Mass. The bishops and visitors stayed over for that, which was acknowledging my 25th year as a bishop. And, here it is 15 years later, which has gone quickly, and I have observed the 40th anniversary yet. Of course, I've been in emeritus status. The modern word for that, I guess, is retired, officially retired. The church, we call that emeritus. But still helping out as best I can, much less during these, since March, because of COVID-19.
Yes, in fact, I remember when two of my children were confirmed, you were the one there doing the confirmation.
Uh-huh, yes. I may not, Bishop Silver's gotten off the schedule for confirmations for this coming spring, hoping that we'll have another auxiliary bishop by then. And I'm not listed for a number of reasons. An anonymous bishop is listed.
Oh, okay.
The unknown auxiliary bishop. But if he isn't named yet, the vicar general and probably myself will continue to help with, in my case, with the smaller groups. It's getting kind of difficult for me. My health is pretty good, but my shoulders are shot.
Mm.
And I can't do the motions that easily anymore that is are required in confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see.
Is the shoulder problem from reeling in Mackinac trout?
I wish I could say that, or from pitching the baseball. But, no, the rotator cuffs wore out. I've had surgery on both. I attempted surgery a second time on one shoulder unsuccessfully.
Yeah.
But it's part of the inheritance. I got the genes in my family gene pool. Especially on my mother's side of the family, seems to have shoulders that wear out, bad arthritis, and so mine have worn out just like my siblings and others before us.
Hmm. So everybody that I talk to, when they walk into that cathedral, whether they're a faithful Catholic, not so faithful Catholic, or maybe a tourist in Sacramento, are just blown away by the beauty of that renovation.
Yes, that is true, and I had many people yesterday telling me that of those who were present, the bigger group was out in the plaza.
Mm-hmm.
But the loudspeaker is out there. They could follow and they receive communion and so forth. I personally don't think that makes any sense. But those are restrictions the governor of California have imposed upon us without much understanding of the importance of the practice of our faith, Mass and the sacraments. And he should know better because he's a Catholic.
He is Catholic, yeah.
Raised a Catholic, at least.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if
you could... many people were telling me that about the beauty of the cathedral, how proud they are of it. And I had lots of emails from friends in Salt Lake City,
mm-hmm.
where I was bishop for a little over 13 years prior to coming to Sacramento. And many people over there are aware of my 40 years. But a number of them were commenting about the beauty of the restored cathedral in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, the Madeleine?
That took place on my watch also. So mm-hmm. I happened to be the one, the right person at the right time, I guess, when seismic strengthening in both cases, both cathedrals was needed, and a major refurbishing. And in both cases, it was quite costly, but the end product was well worth it.
Three or four years ago, I was with my family in Salt Lake City, and we went to that very cathedral, and it too is spectacular.
Yes, quite a different style. And
right.
Different art, but yes, by all means, spectacular.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but some of your Mormon friends actually contributed to that. Is that right?
Yes. The major part of the income came from Catholics, including some Catholic business people,
mm-hmm.
Corporations. Whose CEOs were Catholic, that sort of thing. But the Mormon Church gave us a contribution, and a number of Mormon business people, and there was kind of a dynamic, I was going to say, a lesser Mormon person that gave a huge... contribution,
mm-hmm.
Like it was $400,000 or $500,000.
Wow!
But Mormon in name, but not a power,
mm-hmm.
In the upper echelons of the Mormon Church.
And, right.
And there was kind of a one-upmanship going on that we were able to. Take advantage of, I guess, public people who want to do their fair share in keeping the community functioning properly and so forth. But there's also a certain kind of name recognition in the public sphere. So some of that dynamic helped us actually in Salt Lake City,
mm-hmm.
It did not help us in the same way in Sacramento.
No.
It was interesting how the Mormon-Catholic dynamic is a quite different cultural reality.
Mm-hmm.
And here in California, we have much more of a very secular, non-religious culture.
Right.
At times, almost a hostility towards religion.
Many times, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, the church is sent at the beginning of your tenure and carried on. What was it, Bishop? Did Bishop Wester? Did he succeed you?
No, it was Bishop. Niederauer.
Oh, that's right. He was from San Francisco as well, right?
He was from Los Angeles,
uh-huh.
but became and was for 11 years the Bishop of Salt Lake City before being transferred San Francisco as okay. the Archbishop.
Okay, right. And then Bishop Wester, who's now
Bishop Wester, Santa Fe. Him, yeah. Yes.
Right. And the church is really growing in Utah, isn't it?
Yes, it is, particularly because of the growing economy, put it mm-hmm. that way, with a large influx of people not originally from Utah.
Right.
And a large percentage of them happen to be Catholic.
Right.
A good part of them are lower-income people, Hispanics, who like here in California, for that matter, but also in Utah, who come in for the lower-income jobs in the agricultural sector, but also in the hospitality,
mm-hmm.
Hotels, restaurants, right. and so forth. And, of course, they go up the ladder like every other immigrant group. So that you have, I've been away from Salt Lake City now for 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, people I knew who were in the lower income range are not that way now. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Their kids went to school, went to college, have a good job, and working in the banks and the industry and so forth, just like others. But then there's a newer group that come in that takes the lower incomes. It's constantly rotating.
Indeed it is, yeah. So, Bishop, you were, let's go back to the beginning. You were born in Bend, Oregon, a beautiful city, which I'm sure has changed, grown tremendously and become a huge tourist hub since you were there. Did you grow up in Bend as well?
No. Bend at the time was a fairly small city.
Mm-hmm.
But my father was working for J.C. Penney Company.
Mm-hmm.
And in Bend, he was the assistant manager of the J.C. Penney store,
mm-hmm.
but quickly became appointed the manager of another store and was transferred to the Washington coast to Aberdeen.
Aberdeen, yeah.
And Holcrim.
Yep.
He was actually stationed in Holcrim for most of that time, for a number of years.
So.
Pardon me, that is not correct. He was first in Holcrim, mm-hmm. then went to Bend. From Bend was transferred to Eastern Washington as the manager of a store in Odessa, Washington,
oh, yeah.
which is about an hour and a half west of Spokane.
I think it's wheat country, isn't it?
Yes, wheat country, and then after a few years, to a town south of Spokane, Tico,
mm-hmm.
Washington. Again, agricultural, some wheat, but a lot of peas and
right.
lentils.
Right.
And then after a few years, after eight or 9 years, was transferred to St. Mary's, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
Only about 35, 40 miles away on the Idaho side of the border to so manager of the store in St. Mary's and died early there after 5 years. And I was 18 at the time and in the seminary by then, but mm-hmm. I was, because living in Idaho, was ordained as a priest for the Diocese of Boise, which mm-hmm. Entails the entire state of Idaho.
And people should note that you said Boise, not Boise. It's
yes.
pronounced with an S, not a Z. I learned that the hard way. And so.
Well, good. As a priest of Idaho, I was stationed in the north for a year, and then in the south, in the Boise, well, in Boise itself, for 4 years. Much of that time working at the bishop's office. But after being ordained 5 years, I went to the Idaho mission project in Cali, Colombia, where I was pastor of St. John the Baptist Parish there for 10 years and had come back to Idaho. I was pastoring a parish west of Boise, almost on the Oregon border. Homedale, Marcin Wilder, again, an agricultural area, but a multicultural, tricultural, trilingual of English, Spanish, Basque, and actually a fourth, not language-wise, but a large group. They called themselves Austrians, but they were actually from the old, what we knew as Yugoslavia. But when they migrated to the U.S. and immigrated in 1914, it was all part of the Austrian Empire, anyway.
Austro-Hungarian.
The Austro-Hungarian, yep, right. So they...
Were they actually war refugees?
It was a very interesting pastoring, but it was there after only 3 years I was named to be the Bishop of Salt Lake City to replace Bishop Joseph Federal.
Wow. So the 10 years in Cali, Colombia, was that something you volunteered for? Was it something your bishop suggested? How did that come about?
The bishop did not suggest it, but the popes had asked the U.S. bishops to help out Latin America with personnel. The first one was John the 23rd, actually, and Pope Paul the 6th followed, as did John Paul II. And so Bishop Sylvester Trinan, the Bishop of Boise, consulting with the priest, decided to do something and developed a relationship with Colombia, in part because there were already Benedictines, sisters from Idaho, working in Bogota, Colombia. And the priest, Bishop Trinan, sent to kind of research the possibilities, had been my vocation director. And Bishop, Father Nicholas Walsh, who eventually became a bishop also. And after studying the different options in Colombia, he decided the circumstances in Cali, Colombia, were best. It was a needy, one of the three biggest cities in Colombia, where in recent years, recent at that time, there was a huge influx of campesinos from the mountainous areas into the cities, in part because of violence and also wanting a better health care and job opportunities. But when they first arrived, they were very poor, without anything, often starting in kind of squatting villages on the periphery of the cities. And after a few years, parishes would get organized and gradually city services also in those periphery villages. Father Walsh picked, and Bishop Trinet eventually approved, setting up, taking a parish in the periphery, the poor outlying periphery of College Columbia. The parish assigned to us had the patron saint of St. John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
So Father Walsh stayed there for a number of years. A classmate of mine volunteered and also went down to join him, and they both told me about it and recommended that I think about it. I did, and I put my name in the hat for being appointed. I did not. The bishop basically joked that I was playing games, but I did not want to outright volunteer.
Right.
I wanted to make myself available and make him appoint me.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what he did, so that I could be sure God was behind it.
Yeah.
I figured if the bishop appoints me, then all will go well.
All will go
well. And it did. And I stayed, the term was 2 years, renewable, but I stayed for three terms.
Mm-hmm.
And almost another year, so almost 10 years.
So what had you been there before? Did you know anything at all about the area?
No, but I had, even in the seminary, the bishop at the time foresaw that we would need to learn Spanish, so...
Mm-hmm.
He asked us to study Spanish even in the seminary, and we sort of did. We did, but we sort of learned, you know, how that goes.
Right.
But the 2 years before I was ordained a priest, two different summers, I was, by initiative of that same vocation director, Father Nick Walsh, was invited and basically asked to go to the Mexican National Seminary in Las Vegas, New Mexico.
Right. Up in the mountains.
Up in the mountains, yeah. North of Santa Fe.
Right.
I recall about 7,000 foot elevation.
Yeah, almost exactly. It's I think New Mexico Highlands,
the,
is it? Yeah.
The seminarian stayed there all year round, so during their vacation time and ours, several of us were asked to go and pick up the culture, but also to learn better the language.
Mm.
So two different summers just prior to my ordination, I spent, 2.5 months,
mm-hmm.
the major part of the summer. That seminary ceased to function some years later. At the time, it was kept open and by the U.S. bishops to help the Mexican church following the persecution of the late 20s and all through the 30s, where the church was outlawed and seminaries were outlawed and... So the U.S. bishop set up with the help of Jesuits from Mexico, set up and operated the seminary in New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
for seminarian candidates from Mexico. And it was a marvelous cooperation between two countries, two different groups of bishops. So when I went to Columbia, I already knew Spanish fairly well, but I had to learn it better there, of course, also.
Were the dialects any different, or was it pretty much the same?
It was quite similar. lots of words and expressions, the language of the day, you know, the the way I want to say street talk, I guess, is quite different than that sort of language, either in Mexico or here in among Mexican or Spanish-speaking people here in the United States. So there's quite a learning curve, of course.
So what were your biggest challenges in Cali, especially early on?
Basically, as foreigners and with limitation of language and certainly of culture, the biggest challenge was to develop teams of associates, lay people, who would show us what to do, basically. Mm-hmm. That's where I learned, how to work in a team, and to depend on lay leaders. I had a well-trained social worker, for example, on the team, and was very important. And other professionals, but even gradually, smart, not always well-educated, but smart, very skilled local people from the parish, poor people, who began to learn how to assist us in going out and visiting the sick, identifying those who need to be visited, and to help us keep track of them, and also people who help us keep track of people who needed basic essentials because of their circumstances, needed basic foodstuffs, helped to get some medical prescriptions. A lower rung social workers, in a sense, who were street smart and had the faith and wanted to help us reach out and identify the most needy and to help in all the ways needed. Food, medical supplies, basic education. We developed quite a scholarship program to help talented boys and girls go to the better high schools,
mm-hmm.
and to get a good education, all of whom went on to colleges. And
wow.
But again, just a couple of us with a population of 60,000 people in our parish there, and all in different levels of poverty, but the upper end being lower middle class and better educated, but the lower end being absolutely destitute. And so organizing teams to deal with all of that, I know a bit about organizing in this country, but it's the culture is very different there, so we had to depend almost entirely on what the people there recommended and the social worker that helped us. But that was a wonderful situation to be in. By the way, looking back at it, even at the time, I mean, the priest was greatly honored,
mm-hmm.
but in a way, we were just among the many leaders that were needed to run that parish and to keep track of all the people and to do all the things necessary to organize the catechism classes, for example, the First Communion classes, the groups to receive First Communion and organizing. We had a dozen different very active youth groups, given our population, but over 50% of the population was under 15 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So we had all kinds of kids and young people. And looking back, I think we did a pretty good job in organizing them and keeping them occupied. We had sports programs and all kinds of things, but especially a concern about teaching the faith. And so depending on the local people and affirming them was a wonderful experience. And I often think I learned how to be a bishop down there,
mm-hmm.
where you have to, you're not hands-on in the parishes, in the streets, you're working through all kinds of other people, priests, sisters, lay leaders, deacons. And I had that very kind of situation on the parish level there in Cali, Colombia. So it was a wonderful experience where I learned a lot and got an awful lot done, but not alone.
So in recent years, you've been back to Cali?
Yes, I've made quite a few visits back.
Mm-hmm.
The last time, I think, was 3.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I took Monsignor Murphy with me that time,
mm-hmm.
to assist me and also to kind of witness, even that many years later, 45 years after my leaving that parish, people still knew who I was.
Wow.
Now, a lot of people had died in the meantime, but young people who were in those youth groups, now grandparents,
wow.
kids who went to college, had a career, raised kids, and came out in droves to greet me. We had masses, or we had meetings, and it was quite an eye-opener for Monsignor Murphy. In a way, it didn't surprise me because I have maintained contact with certain
mm-hmm.
people down there.
Wow.
But how grateful people are and remember what we tried to do for them.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it, there aren't too many important things in life, but life itself, family, friends, relationships, but the faith.
Mm-hmm.
So people who thought we taught them the faith and helped them keep their faith and celebrated their birthdays, their baptisms, their marriages, and so forth, funerals, many funerals in the families at that time, remain grateful for that and remember that. So it's always beautiful to see. The same is true in this country, in our diocese, in our parishes also, how grateful people are, those who value their faith and
mm-hmm.
realize that it took some faith-filled parents and some hardworking sisters and teachers, but also priests who helped them grow up and helped them understand and treasure their faith.
Was it hard leaving Cali in 1977 after 10 years?
It was, But I knew it was the right thing. In part, I was already having some health issues. I didn't know what it was. It was diagnosed only a few months after I became a bishop that I had a liver disease.
Which you
primary sclerosing cholangitis. And it developed very slowly in my case. But I was already feeling that. Plus, I knew that I would have to either leave or stay there for the rest of my life. I was so deeply involved by that time, I either had to leave or stay.
And right.
I presented that dilemma to Bishop Trinan, my bishop in Idaho, and I said, I'm willing to do either. You tell me what to do. And he said, it's time to come home.
Mm-hmm.
So I went home.
And you ended up in Homedale.
I ended up in Homedale. that became my home. And 3 years later, as bishop of Salt Lake City, Idaho and Utah are neighboring states.
Right.
So being from the southern, at that time, in the southern part of Idaho, it wasn't, it made some sense to, and I knew Spanish, that's what they were looking for. An influx of Spanish-speaking people in Utah, and the outgoing bishop and the priest and other leaders of the diocese had made it clear to the apostolic nuncio that we need a bishop who speaks Spanish and understands the need to develop ministry to the Spanish-speaking. So here I was nearby, and I got called on.
And southern Idaho has a pretty fair population of Mormons.
Yes. Yes, uh-huh.
That's very interesting.
Especially southeastern Idaho. It's about like Utah's, for that matter.
Exactly. Yeah. What were you doing when you got the call, and who called you to say you're going to be a bishop?
Oh, my, you're tempting me to tell a story, but it's a true story. I actually got, the systems change depending on the moment in the church, but also the technology. At that time, there was no internet or anything, and anyway, the system at that time, the nuncio at that time called the apostolic what did we call it?
Nuncio.
Yes, nuncio. Yeah. Anyway, he called Bishop Trinan, my bishop.
Mm-hmm.
And then followed up with a letter. It was a letter that important. So the Bishop Trinan got a letter. I didn't. Asking him to call me in to tell me that Pope John Paul II, who was only recently named the Pope at that time, just a couple of years before,
right,
that John Paul II would ask me to go and become the Bishop of Salt Lake City. So my bishop, one evening, it's actually the 29th of August, in 1980, in the evening, called me and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm finishing dinner or something like that. and he said, I just got back from the trip. I'm going through my mail, and there's something I need to talk to you about. I want to meet you. Would you meet me halfway, about 50 miles from Boise to Homedale? Let's meet halfway at an off ramp in from I-84.
Yeah, right.
on the east side of Nampa.
In Nampa,
Idaho.
yeah, exactly.
not Napa, Nampa.
Yeah, with an M.
With an M.
Yes.
And he told me which off-ramp, and I went. By the time and he went, he said, meet me, get off that off-ramp, and you'll see there's a Mexican restaurant. meet me in the parking lot of the Mexican restaurant. So I drove over. By the time I got there, it was close to 9 o'clock. It was dark, even late August, 1980.
Yeah.
And I had to look for him. He had a small car. I forget the brand. So I found him on the very back part of the parking lot, the darkest part of the parking lot. He said, get in. I got into the car, and he read me this letter. And he says, the Pope wants you to be the bishop of Salt Lake City. Will you accept? And I said, I don't know. I said, I will have to pray about it and consult and think about it. And he says, I've got to get a response back. And I basically said, sorry, that's your problem. I need to pray about this and talk to my spiritual director, and I need 2 or 3 days. And he said, I said, well, why don't you call the Apostolic Nuncio and just explain that I don't reject it. I just need to talk to God. And he said, okay, I don't think he expected that. But I said, well, how do you, what do you do? He said, well, what I'm supposed to do, according to this letter, so I guess there was a postscript to the letter that he said, I there's a code. I have to telegraph back to the nuncio in Washington, D.C., a code, and there's two parts to it. One if I say yes, one if I say no. And so I was glad to hear that. So I said, so it's okay if I say no. And he said, well, yes, but we're priests. We do what the Pope wants us to do. And so in theory, yes, but, you know, he was gently trying to say, hey, you're kind of expected to say yes. And I said, well, what's the code? I was curious. And he said, well, if you say yes, I fax back, telegraph. What's another word for telegraph?
Telegram. Yeah, that's about
telegram,
it.
Telegram, yeah.
Yeah.
I send a telegram back that says the study on the old Latin Mass is forthcoming. And I said, what? he says, this is what it says.
That's funny.
And the code, if I say yes, is the study of the old Latin Mass is forthcoming, or will come soon, or will be. Anyway, about the old Latin Mass, I say, wow, they really are secretive, aren't they? no one would guess that code. And I don't remember what it was if my answer was no. But in any case, I think it was 3 days. I prayed. I talked to my spiritual director, a couple of other confidants, including that one that I said had been my vocation director, and started the mission in Cali, Colombia. By then, he was a bishop himself. I consulted with him. And as quick as possible, got back to Bishop Kleinen, and I said, yes, I will accept that. And he sent the code back to the by telegram to the nuncio. And the very next day, so I think that by then it was September 2nd, when I eventually got the document from Rome, it showed the appointment took place dated September 3.
Yeah.
I mean, they were really fast, and I figured out later the reason. The nuncio was finishing his term in Washington, D.C., was already packing his bags to go back to Europe, first of all, to Rome. And he was trying to get a few things finished before the end of the year, after which he was flying off back to Rome. So it was, the nuncio on this side and the apostolic, at the time was apostolic delegate.
Right.
And but the equivalent in Rome, the secretariat for bishops, was also wanting loose ends in Washington, D.C., a number of things cleaned up before the apostolic delegate left. So it was really fast. So my appointment as Bishop of Salt Lake City took place September 3, 1980. I wasn't actually ordained until November 17.
Mm-hmm.
And installed as ordained bishop and installed in the Cathedral of Saint Mary Magdalene. It's called the Magdalene, the Cathedral of the Madeleine. Mm-hmm. Pardon me, the Madeleine.
The Madeleine, yeah.
But the French way of talking about Mary Magdalene.
Right. Well, Bishop Soto, Bishop Wiegand, we have run out of time. We need to get you back on.
Okay. That means either you or I are, I guess both of us, very talkative. But
we are.
This is Bob, and I don't know what any of that means to our listeners, but God bless you. And my ministry now is mainly a prayer. I include all of you in my prayers.
Thank you, Bishop. That means so much to all of us. Bishop William Wiegand, celebrating 40 years as a bishop, starting in Salt Lake City and concluding here in the Diocese of Sacramento, and it hasn't concluded yet. And we'll look forward to our paths crossing again real soon.
Yes, God bless.
God bless you, too. Thanks, Bishop. That's Bishop William Wiegand, the Bishop of the Diocese of Sacramento, Bishop Emeritus of the Diocese of Sacramento. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless.
I was sure by now, God, you would have reached down and wiped our tears away, stepped in and saved the day. But once again, I say amen, and it's still raining. But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear you whisper through the rain, I'm with you. And as your mercy falls, I'll raise my hands. hands and praise the God who gives and takes away. And I'll praise you in this storm, and I will lift my hands, for you are who you are, no matter where I am. And every tear I've cried, you hold in your hand, you never left my side. And though my heart is torn, I will praise you in the storm. Remember when I stumbled in the wind, you heard my cry to you and raised me up again. But my strength is almost gone, how can I carry on if I can't find you? But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear you whisper through the rain, falls. I'll raise my hands and praise the God who gives and takes away.